that's what happens in chapter 4. We get set up with this battle, and the ark is captured. And then we get to see what the Philistines do with the ark. And this is the piece of hilarity as far as I'm concerned. My archaeology professor left the University of Chicago and went back to his alma mater, Harvard, and I just, about 6 weeks ago, heard him on the radio. He's been digging for the last 4 or 5 years in Ashkelon. And a National Public Radio who was defending the honor of the Philistines, that they are not the boors that we make them out to be, talking about their very fine pottery and their seafaring ways and so on. He's at Harvard, so we won't pay any attention. Let's see, we've got the Scandinavians and Harvard. Is there anyone else we need to get this morning?
Harvard graduates are watching your son this afternoon.
They used to be.
Yeah. Someone pick up with 5:1-5.
After the Philistines captured the covenant box, they carried it from Ebenezer to their city of Ashdod, took it into the temple of their god Dagon, and set it up beside his statue. Early the next morning, the people of Ashdod saw that the statue of Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground in front of the Lord's covenant box. So they lifted it up and put it back in its place. Early the following morning, they saw that the statue had again fallen down in front of the covenant box. This time, its head and both its arms were broken off and were lying in the doorway. Only the body was left. That is why, even today, the priests of Dagon and all his worshippers in Ashdod step over that place and do not walk on it.
You read that so well. Where'd you go to school?
Harvard.
MIT.
Someone's not telling me the truth. There is that possibility, isn't there? The whole truth. This story is, this beginning piece is great already, but we've got this idea that the god of the Philistines, or the god of the gods of the Philistines, each of the cities probably had their own primary deity, or at least called their primary deity by different names, has won the battle and is the superior god. And the Ark of the Covenant is brought in as a symbol of subservience. This is what you would do. You'd capture the city, the enemy's chief city, you'd collect their gods, you'd take them back to your temple and put them in as servants to your god, as you would do with their people, your captives. And here we have the Ark of the Covenant brought in to make this symbolic service. And the next morning we walk in Dagon is face down in a position of worship. And they, these Philistines, they don't get it. They just set them back up in the superior position. And the next morning they come in, and now it's clear that a real battle has taken place. Head is decapitated, arms are removed. He has really lost the battle. And then there's this little piece of etiology here that a piece is on the threshold, and so those who know that the priest and the worshippers of Dagon won't step on the threshold, and it's explained in this story by it's explained by this story. But the main piece here, the reason for the inclusion of this story is, I think, to say that you can't take the Ark of the Covenant in and expect the God of Israel to be subservient to any other god, because this God is superior to any other god. And it took the Philistines a little while to get it. This wasn't enough, of course, because they're Philistines. The hand of the Lord was heavy upon the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and struck them with tumors, both in Ashdod and its territory. And when the inhabitants of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, the Ark of the Lord, the Ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is heavy on us and our god Dagon. So after everyone's, after this is taking place 2 days in a row, and everyone's struck with some sort of tumors, boils, or you know, some sort of affliction, which they themselves had predicted when they heard this shout go up in the camp of Israel. Now it's sinking in that this is not a God to be messed with.
My text says hemorrhoids.
Yeah, you've got that translation. I think anyone reading the King James and some other translations that follow will have hemorrhoids. Well, that actually comes from the sickness actually comes from the Greek text, where there's an addition about rats, which is to explain the sickness that's going through. But it may in fact have been the plague.
Yeah, that's bubonic plague in the footnotes.
Yeah. So, what do? Do they send it back?
Take it to Gath.
Of course not. Because the people of Gath, one of these other Philistine cities, say, well, the guys at Ashdod, they just must be sort of doltish. Why don't you bring it up here? And we'll have it for a while. We'll have this prize. That the Egyptians couldn't handle and the men of Ashdod couldn't handle. But when they get to Gath, the city goes into the same sort of a panic, and this continues. It goes on for, I think, 7 months. The people of Gath want to send it up to Ekron, and the people of Ekron, they catch on pretty quickly. Down in... Where is that? That's verse 10. So they sent the Ark of God of Israel to Ekron, but when the Ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out. This is actually reminiscent of the why have you brought us out, cried out, why have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness? Why have they brought around to kill us the Ark of the God of Israel and our people? They sent therefore and gathered all the lords. They had a little powwow among the chiefs, the kings of the Pentapolis, and they came up with a plan. You're going to send it back to Israel, but this, you know, four and five to me are just great material for any comedian who's got a slightly religious audience that may have read this material before, or will sit down for a story. They called their priests and their diviners, and they say, what shall we do with this? And they say, well, let's have just a little test. We'll get two milk cows that have never been trained for the yoke. We'll hide their calves so they won't go right to their calves. And we'll put them on the road. And if they go up to Beth Shemesh, then we know it was the God of Israel. If they go anyplace else, we know it's just another piece of bad luck that we need to deal with. But of course... the cows go up straight away to Beth Shemesh, and the Philistines sort of wipe their brow. Think that piece of bad luck is gone. But it's not enough just to send it up. They're going to send up five golden hemorrhoids. Tumors. Pardon?
Five gold mice.
And five gold mice from the Greek text. As a guilt offering to this god, in case they're right. And you got to say a word about in the ancient world, unlike today, where no one hedges their bets on religion, or at least none of the faithful, you often see statements like it is wise to honor the gods of the land. Everyone, Greeks, Romans, all the Semites, the Egyptians pretty much didn't go anywhere, so they didn't do that so much.
Norwegian should do it. Stop churches have all their little pagan symbols to make sure that in case they weren't.
Yeah, but you go into another land and you would pay homage, worship with a sacrifice or an offering the god of that place. It's just. And the tradition continues to some extent with a hostess or host gift. You go into someone's house and you take them a little gift. Well, they're the ones who are charged to protect you while you're in their house, while you're their guest.
Now, the tourist books say you should come prepared to drink the local wine.
And when in Rome, do as the Romans do. In 613, when the ark shows up in Beth Shemesh, the people, of course, are excited to have it back, and they make sacrifices, and they're just delighted, probably especially with the fact that the Philistines won't be bothering them for a while, since they're a border town. But if you look down in verse 20, you'll see that they're not much different from the Philistines, maybe a little smarter, maybe a little quicker, in that immediately after the sacrifices, they say, or almost immediately after the sacrifices, then the people of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? To whom shall he go that we may be rid of him?" Yeah. Sounds like the way we used to sing a particular hymn in college, Fine Lutheran College, "Take My Life and Let It Be." To whom shall he go that we may be rid of him? I mean, there's a real sense here that this does not belong in our presence. It is too holy, too awesome for us. And they've got to get it into a cult place, an appropriate sanctuary. So they send word to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the ark, come down and take it up." And the people there came down and took the ark and brought it to the house of Abinadab, who on a hill. When you read later text, you'll hear about the Israelites, the northern Israelites, worshiping on every high place and under every green tree. You know, we still like to put churches in very visible places. You know, if anybody's ever been on a synodical or a conference church growth committee, or whatever we call them these days, where do you put the church? Well, where it's going to get the most traffic, where people are most likely to see it and decide that they're going to stop in. Sanctuaries in these days were typically put in high places up on the hills. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge over the ark of the Lord. So in this story we see the end of the line of Eli as the high priest at Shiloh. This is that line that will then be sort of in quasi-exile, only carried forward through the line of Ichabod. But there'll be an Anathoth, and apparently Jeremiah comes out of this tradition because he remembers the travesty at Shiloh and reminds the people of Jerusalem about it. When they think that nothing can happen to Jerusalem because it's God's holy and chosen city, he says, "Remember Shiloh." And we have the starting up of the line of Eleazar as the priest in this story. So we get when we get to David, we have these two lines running parallel to one another. And we have the ark going back and forth, sort of a hot potato. Ark, who's getting, no, you take it. You know, first they steal it, and then they send it from here to here, from Ashdod to Gath to Ekron to Beth Shemesh, and Beth Shemesh finally to Kiriath-Jearim. From that day, from the day of the ark was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, according to the text, and all the house of Israel, it says, lamented. And if you've got any kind of an annotated Bible, you should have a note that says, "We don't know what that word means quite for sure." Lamented, feared the Lord. So then we get this period of peace, and then finally, in 7, we have the establishment, the real firm establishment of Samuel as the judge, political, moral leader of Israel. Any questions or comments thus far?
What was Samuel's relationship then to
the place where the ark ended up, so that other line.
There's not one, and this begins to set up this competition between the two priestly lines, one old priestly line and one new priestly line.
Well, Samuel's not related to Ichabod either. Samuel's just...
He's not genetically related, but... yes. All creation is broken loose outside. And the kids out here in the water spraying up. He has received the mantle through prophecy.
So that's a competition between Samuel's line and Eliezer's?
Oh. Samuel will carry forward Eli's line, at least in place and in authority. And so Shiloh isn't out of the picture yet, because Samuel's going to work in part from there.
And you mentioned Jeremiah. Is Jeremiah descended from Ichabod or Samuel?
We would fudge on that. I will fudge on that and say Jeremiah is theologically the descendant of Samuel, but genetically probably the descendant of Ichabod. Okay. So things seem to have gotten straightened out somewhat in Shiloh with Samuel's leadership. Anything else? Let's see what Samuel does then. Someone pick up with 3 through 6.
Then Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, "If you're returning to Yahweh with all your heart, put aside the foreign gods you now have, and the Astartes too, and set your heart on Yahweh and serve him alone, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines." And the Israelites put aside the Baals and Astartes and served Yahweh alone.
Can you go 2 more?
Then Samuel said, "Muster all Israel at Mizpah, and I will plead with Yahweh for you." So they mustered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before Yahweh. They fasted that day and declared, "We have sinned against Yahweh." And it was at Mizpah that Samuel was judge over the Israelites.
Okay.
The Philistines, do you want to 17?
No, let's stop there. Let's flip back for a minute to the book of Judges, chapter 3. Seven through 11. This is what we've just seen, and what I tend to tell my classes when we go through the Deuteronomistic history, this history that picks up the theology of Deuteronomy and uses, it's probably written about the same time, is that there's a cycle of sin and subjugation, repentance, and salvation. And we've just seen it, seen a piece of it in that story in 4 through the beginning of 7, and we'll see it borne out in 7. But it's if you want it in a nutshell, the whole Deuteronomistic history, it's in the book of Judges, which is where it happens over and over and over again. But the shortest version of it, the neatest version of it, is in Judges 3, 7 through 11. The Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, forgetting the Lord their God and worshiping Baals and Asherahs, a different feminine deity here. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the king of Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram-Naharaim. And the Israelites served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the Israelites who delivered them. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave King Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram into his hands, and he prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the land had rest for 40 years. Then Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. So we sin, and in this case of Deuteronomistic history, it's always the same sin, worshiping other gods, the gods of the surrounding nations. They're sold into the hands of the neighbor who subjugates them. They cry out and repent, as we just saw here in 7:6. God has mercy on them and sends a deliverer, and then there's a period of rest in the book of Judges. Success, freedom for a specified period, usually 20 or 40 years in the book of Judges. And that's, so Samuel is set here at yet another beginning of his ministry, or the beginning of his adult ministry. Now he's got to be in his 20s, maybe 30s. It's 20 years later from a few years after his call, or a few, at least a little while after his call, when he was a lad. Now he's an adult, stepping into full leadership, centered at Mizpah. If someone would pick up and take us from 7 through 11, and this one, in chapter 4, or chapter 7 of 1 Samuel.
When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. And when the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. And they said to Samuel, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines." Then Samuel took a sucking lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him.
Through 11.
While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day the Lord thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines, and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah to pursue the Philistines, slaughtering them along the way to the point of the Mizpah.
Okay. So where does Beth Parker Carr is what I've always wondered. The routing of the Philistines here is an interesting piece because the Israelites have nothing to do with it. There's this thundering from God. They're routed before the Israelites. And after the rout takes place and they're running away, then the Israelites run out and chase them down, which is fairly typical of the early stories of Israelites' warfare where they're winning. And it's part of the holy war, especially the people in the peace churches who follow the holy war argument, or the Yahweh war argument, argue that it's the early stories where God does all the fighting, like the Song of Deborah, in the Song of Deborah in Judges 5, in Exodus 14, the crossing of the Red Sea, the Israelites do nothing at all. God does all the fighting, and then if the Israelites do anything, they go and kind of mop up the mess afterwards. So there's no need for us to have an army at all. Because every time we've seen here that the Israelites actually fight, they and on their own accord, they lose.
They're not trained as soldiers either.
The Israelites?
Right.
No. And few people were at this point. A few centuries later when Alexander will march down, his soldiers aren't really quite trained as soldiers. They're tribesmen who learn how to be soldiers as they keep winning and have a great strategist in their leader. But these guys are basically farmers who take up arms. In 12 through 14, we get another etiological story for the naming of this place that we've heard consistently throughout the story, Ebenezer. Eben is stone, Ezer is help, the rock of my help. There's a story of what's happening there. And then in 15 to the end of the chapter, kind of a statement of Samuel's really being established as the judge in Israel for all the days of his life. So that's what happens when you mess with the Ark of God, and that's why, as we all know, according to Indiana Jones, it's hidden somewhere in the Pentagon's bowels. Because even we, like the people of Beth Shemesh, are not worthy to be in the presence of this holy God, and we've got to keep it in a safe place. Yeah, I thought so too. We have a couple minutes for questions or comments about any of this material. Yeah?
I just had a question about the word Beth, and when it's Beth Car, it's two separate words, and when it's Beth El, it's connected.
Yeah, and actually in my translation, it's Beth Kar is one word. Beth, Beit is house, El is God, Kar is probably the circuit. I didn't look it up in the Hebrew, but Beth at the beginning, in some cases at the end of a name, is Beth Shemesh, is house of the sun. It's a place, a deity. I'm trying to remember what Elizabeth means. Is anybody here named Elizabeth? Remember what it means? I think that's a. It may not be the same Beth. It may be a different ending. But usually Beth in a place name is almost always house of something. So Bethel is house of God. Pardon?
Beit Lechem.
It's interesting, either it's house of food for sure, but in Arabic lechem is meat, and Hebrew lechem is bread, and there's also an old Semitic deity Lachmu, so it might be the temple, the house of Lachmu, this deity.
What happens to Ichabod?
I don't know that we hear about him at all. After this, until Washington Irving.
That's right. And he loses his head.
At least he must not have done anything terrible.
Yeah, he didn't do anything terrible. We didn't hear of him. My guess is that somewhere tucked away, and I don't know if this is true, there's a short genealogy that connects this resurgent, but for a while dormant, priestly line with Ichabod and Hophni and Phinehas. Mm-hmm. But I don't know where it is. I didn't expect anyone to ask that question.
Next. I find it interesting about, we said the technology of these Philistines, they had chariots, and you mentioned something else. So they
iron.
And the Israelites didn't have that. And so the only way they could defeat these technologically superior people is with a pretty powerful God. I mean, it's kind of a very strong faith statement that these people, did not have any human reason to be victorious.
Sort of like North Vietnam. Sorry.
Yeah.
And that's how national identities get forged, national mythologies. That story is actually in the Song of Deborah, or the story around Deborah's winning and why the Philistines are so powerful. And what happens there is that there's a tremendous cloud burst before the battle, and all these iron, these wheeled chariots and these iron-holding folks get bogged down in the mud. And so their chariots become not only useless, but a detriment. But you're right. It is a tremendous faith statement. It's the kind of thing that forges. They continue to look back to, we beat the Philistines, who caused great trouble for Egypt, caused great trouble up in Anatolia, just basically ended civilizations. They didn't end us because God wanted us to survive. The second intermediate period in Egypt is connected with the arrival of the Sea Peoples from Scandinavia.
From Venice.
Scandinavia via Venice. Tomorrow we will look at the audacity of something that's never been done since then, of the Israelites to ask God to step aside as the king of the nation, and to replace himself, to choose his own, as Bob Bowling at McCormick Seminary says, they had the audacity to ask God to step aside, and while he was doing it, to please choose his own successor. And that's in 1 Samuel 8.
Mm. Thank you.
Psychiatry, psychology, really around that big four. Really work, but they don't work. And I studied the Myers-Briggs, and I studied Freud, and the way that people, they're trying to, it seems like safety. If I can put you in a box, that way I can deal with it. And with the Enneagram, it's not useful at all. It doesn't do any good to call somebody, too, because what does it do for you? What it does is when you find your own type, you get into some way. And it seems like, I was talking with your dad at the conference. That's not your dad. You're just somebody else. I'm sorry.
Yeah, somebody else.
Okay, because you look very much like this. He was telling me that what he had heard is that the Sufis, there wasn't a lot to do through that. Worked and years and die. And he said what they did was they would sit around and watch people all the time. And they began to watch how people behave. Because everybody in the family knew everybody. You knew the family they came from, you know, what sort of things went on at home. Everybody knew everybody. So and so's grandson, this was, you know, Abdul's grandson, and you knew all about that kid because you knew all about his family, his genealogy, and his family's living. All this common knowledge of small towns. About the size of Golden Village. Yeah. Because you couldn't support many more people from that based on their agriculture. They just didn't have farmers that you couldn't raise too much food to support very large communities. So, since you could walk, kind of determine and say, yeah, and if you travel maybe 40 miles.
Make sure home, they're all in the right setup.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So the idea is that
they, in the bookstore,
by observing,
Dakota. And I don't know why that is, because earlier, one of my colleagues taught a whole
series
of
different.
His series was on
women's
spiritual writers. And he taught Dakota, and we didn't even have it then. So I suspect, frankly, that it was a much bigger settlement than people should anticipate. And that it's going to be
going to
people
like
that.
Right.
And
kind of
your publisher, I can't remember the name of the publisher.
Like this guy. So they,
yeah, and you know, if they, together, you know, the title of the author, they can find out who the publisher is.
And then sticking the patch around a circle.
But it, partly, I think
nine,
because she came
you know,
from Manhattan,
columns
she still
or
has
nine squares.
Or a 3x3 grid. Yeah, 3x3 grid.
Yeah, tic-tac-toe sure, hundred squares. So they, like, they realize that this sort of moves over here.
I
would imagine at first the lines would be
another one that came out about a year earlier called Virgin Time by Patricia
Campbell. How much you knew about motivation.
And it has some similarities.
The fact that it's being
I think Campbell is a better writer.
Maybe
I think Norris had more to say.
Georgie.
So, well, actually, the other thing about them is that Campbell's subtitle is
China and looking at all different
like the search for a contemplative life. And she gives you the whole search, sort of pilgrimage. And so once you get to the last chapter, then is the similarities of their view. This
and he came across these guys, lived with them.
The climax of the Virgin Time is when she is searching for a treehouse.
The
and she
bursts
into this,
somewhere
I can't help it, it's just the way I am. This is when
very
she finds
remote.
Prayer.
That's a terror.
There's nothing to
prayer.
I can't help it, it's just the way I am. Well, it sounds so much to me like Norris' realism. But Norris starts with, you know, that's all the way through her book, and Campbell's at the end.
They were in charge of just...
So, but I wrote a review of them together, because I thought they were
and
just very complimentary.
The Enneagram symbol with the circle and the line that I showed you.
Either one were
the
reading.
No, it's like one of those symbols that comes out of antiquity. We go, wonder why they put a B in there. And there was an esoteric society in England.
H-A-M-P-L,
called the Golden Dawn.
Golden Dawn?
Golden Dawn. Yeah, with several, it was sort of, I don't know much about it. I think it started as a sort of offshoot of Freemasons. And then they started accumulating all this esoteric knowledge all over the world. It became sort of like a repository of ancient teachings. And they spent lifetimes looking for things.
All
one, their whole purpose in life might be to find one particular piece of information from
They did have some copies of Virgin Time, but I suspect they all sold.
So, kind of like the Alexandria
Library. I don't think she ordered very many because it was all in hardback.
Did you see like the day you take, trying to figure out what the unification of Myers-Briggs and Abraham?
Yeah, like there's a grain of truth in all of it, and in all the systems that I've ever dealt with, and I've dealt with a lot. I mean, I've lived with everything from astrology to tarot cards. You know, there's got to be something that's joining all this together, because they're just mirrors that are reflecting reality in a way that you can understand. The Enneagram is dynamic, as opposed to the other systems, which seem to be mostly static. With the Enneagram, you take personal responsibility for what you're doing with your life. Astrology says, well, because Jupiter and Saturn are doing this, then that's because of it. And I'm thinking, well, with the Enneagram, you act upon your own life instead of being outside forces and impinge upon you. And then when you develop automatic behavior, it's because you're trying to protect yourself. And as children, we learn that because the world's a big place.
I developed a lot of automatic behavior.
Well, I think we all have.
And I'm conscious of it. For a long time, I was pretty, proud of that. It makes it processing a lot faster if you go automatic. You don't need
it. It's easier.
You don't need to think through decisions. It comes.
Right, and there's certain things like driving a car. If you really had to get into a car and consciously think about everything you have to do to drive, nobody would. It'd be too much work. Okay, I've got to press the accelerator now. Okay, I shift to first gear.
It's like talking about foreign learning, speaking a foreign language. For a long time, doing that, translating all this.
And then you reach that threshold where you step through it and then you're just speaking. It's like mathematics, or it's reading. I mean, reading is the same thing. When we read, we don't think about how we read, we just read. And you watch children struggle with, spelling, phonics, and words, and sentences. They reach a point where suddenly you don't have to coax them anymore. It's just natural to read and see. And that's an automatic learned behavior. And most of our behaviors are learned. But our defense mechanisms, like I talked about yesterday, with the different types moving into their basically push the world back or escape from it, or somehow I'm going to be safe, I've got to be safe. When that happens, it may have been appropriate at one time. It may have been appropriate in your inclined toward the five's perspective. It may have been appropriate at one time when you were faced with a threat to withdraw from it and analyze it and then come at it again. Once you've had a chance to sit back and examine it, that may have been a real appropriate response, especially if you were trying to deal with words you didn't understand in school or somebody came at you. But when you get into, say, a marriage situation, and your spouse is an emotional, heart-centered type of person, and they're dumping feelings on you like you told me today, and they're saying, don't you feel anything? Your natural reaction is to really pull back and analyze what they're saying.
Yeah.
And then start, well, why do you think I should feel anything? Why are you doing this? And so the questions come up. And fives will do that. They'll get under stress and they'll ask questions because they don't know. So it's better to ask the question, and that way more information can come in. And it happens really quickly. So when somebody's going at you emotionally, if you can just not ask questions, just be aware of it enough to go, feel yourself about to ask the question and then check them out. And develop maybe some kind of physical cue that whether it's just taking these three fingers and going like this, and doing it enough that it reminds you that when you do this, don't ask. So that you can observe what's happening, but also not diffuse it. Let them be emotional, because by being with emotional people, that's going to help.
I've made quite a progression from saying things like, you shouldn't feel like that. There's the next one. I don't understand.
I understand.
I mean, to the point where I think it's okay,
Well, what makes you feel that? What have I done? And then they blow up and then they leave with me. You just don't understand, which is the worst thing you can say to a five, because that's what they really want.
And that's been kind of the frustration in our marriage as well. So this has been quite helpful to me. Put the two of us.
Is your wife?
Yeah, she was one of us sitting here, actually. The one who asked the question, who was talking about the... Peter's son Theo, we're going to take him on a hike.
Oh, she was
sitting there. The comment about Harvard. And
oh, the short hair.
Yeah,
sitting there.
Cool.
Okay. What's your name?
Kevin.
And your name is?
Woody.
Woody. Okay. Okay. How long are you guys going to be here in the village?
Till Saturday.
Oh, okay. That's good. See, what I'm going to try and do today, I've had so much interest. I didn't expect this many people to be coming to sessions. I didn't know. That's why I only brought a limited number of candidates. And when the room was packed, I thought, wow, because it may have been more today. I mean, but there's a lot of people who are playing hockey and running to the end of the time. So what I think I'm going to do is have the session at 11:40, since it's already been announced.
But the next one I'll be at, but Friday.
Well, what I'm going to do, I think I'm going to do it again tonight. Because the communication style is, it's a lot of fun, and it's real obvious sometimes. Because it talks about how the different types communicate, not only verbally, but non-verbally. So,
oh yeah,
it's not so important what people wear as how they wear it. And that's, there are various outward behavior characteristics that each of the types uses to get by in the world, to talk to other people, and how they keep their space.
You know, you talked about Vesuvius, this Enneagram and the history of it. Mm-hmm. You know, what do? You watch people and you get insight and develop information, you know, you develop a model or whatever over time. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you're going to watch, I would expect that in that context, is you watch communities, not just individuals. You watch, okay, now, or whole families, and also, I would imagine these two types seem to always fight, and these two types seem to get along okay. And, you know, there'd be more of that kind of information. Mm-hmm. Has there been writings about?
Not a lot of writing about relation. A lot of the books that are out are basically describing the types.
Just everybody in the
just as an individual. Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of, I would say, progressive thinking about it. How to choose a five to what are their expectations of the community? If you have a very emotional two who's very interested in them, they have internal needs that they're afraid to express. So when they express them to you, if you don't think that they're as important as the two does, and you go, oh, well, that's not important. That shuts them down right away, and they get really angry. And when the helper two isn't getting appreciation, which is what they really want. They want thank you. These are the grandmothers that, you know, send gifts to all the grandchildren and get very bent out of shape.
They don't get thank you.
Well, but the thing, if you really want to lead the two, which is, and they won't tell you what they want. And it's almost like they expect you to read their minds because they don't want to impose. And yet they want their needs to be met. So they're catching themselves. They reach out and they pull their hand back. They do it for themselves. So if you send flowers to them unexpectedly, and just a little note that says, I'm really glad you're here. I'm glad that, you know, it's your birthday and, you know, I'm glad you were born, that kind of thing. That will mean more to them. It will keep them smiling for 6 weeks.
Will it bother you guys if I vacuum this?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. I didn't want to disturb you.
No, not at all. It's hard to disturb you. And it's like, I don't know. But if you don't give them the appreciation and the approval that they really want, and that's their normal need, is that need to take their self-identity that I'm helpful, but their need is I need to be appreciated. I want you to say thank you for what I do for you. So they'll keep doing things for you until they get that appreciation. But it's sort of like, you know, if they have to go up to here to get it, and they do a little work, go through a lot of different steps to get it. Well, if you give it to them when they're down here, they don't have to put as much energy and need in them and security. And they can take some of that energy and meet their own needs so that you don't have to keep meeting them. They learn to meet their own needs first. And if they don't get the approval, then they sort of, the line goes from 2 to 8. And they take on the real negative quality of the 8, which means they can't get your approval. At least they'll get your attention.
The 8's
the power. It's about the power.
It's champion.
But see, what happened with the 2 is, it's the kind of thing that if they've done something, they cooked you a wonderful dinner, and you come home late in the morning, and you say, oh, I'm not really hungry. But they feel like they've tried to do something for you, and you